Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. The usual two interviews up today. First, in about 15 minutes, we'll hear from Ann Harrison, a labor economist from Berkeley, on what happened to wages and employment in the shoe industry in Indonesia after activists targeted it with a special focus on Nike for running high-profit sweatshops. Then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from Stephen Hill, author of a new book, Europe's Promise, on how the old world does capitalism a little nicer than we do. I'm not entirely convinced, but we'll let him make his case. First, some brief comments in the news. A little bit of arcana to start. As I point out here from time to time, the monthly employment numbers are based on a survey of employers. It's a very large survey, about 300,000 establishments, but as with any survey, it's necessarily incomplete. It covers only about a quarter of the places that Americans work. You couldn't canvass the entire universe of employers every month and get this data out with anything approaching timeliness. So the government statisticians, which I can't say too many times are extremely competent and dedicated people, the slurs of conspiracy theorists to the contrary, they do their best to turn the survey into an estimate of what's going on throughout the U.S. economy. Most of the time, the survey is pretty good, but it's not so good at times of rapid change. The estimates are periodically corrected by comparing them to the near-complete coverage of the employment universe, about 99% complete, provided by the unemployment insurance system. Once a year, the Bureau of Labor Statistics makes what are called benchmark revisions that align the monthly estimates with the results of the full coverage. And those yearly exercises are supplemented with quarterly releases from the same source, though with a delay of about 6 months. 6 months would be too long to wait for monthly employment figures, but the quarterly audits provide an excellent reality check. As I said, most of the time, the monthly survey is pretty close, within a tenth of a percentage point or two, to the full coverage numbers. But things have been very out of whack during this recession. On Thursday morning, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the BLS, reported that the employment picture last September was even worse than we realized. The regular monthly numbers told us that 6.4 million jobs were lost between September 2008 and September 2009. The full coverage version now tells us that the true loss was 7.1 million. Things looked pretty bad before. Now they look considerably worse. All signs are that the job market is beginning to improve. We'll get a fuller picture when the March figures are released on Friday morning. But the hole we're in is even deeper than we thought, and it's going to take a very long time to climb out of this one.
And now a last-minute insert on the U.S. employment report for March released on Friday morning. I'm traveling and have only the microphone on my laptop to record my pearls of wisdom, so I'll keep these remarks very brief. While the headline job gain of 162,000 looked pretty decent, especially after the huge declines of 2008 and 2009, 30% of the gain came from temporary workers hired to conduct the census, and another 25% came from temp firms in the private sector. These are not, of course, great jobs. There were a few bright spots. Manufacturing added 17,000 workers, its third consecutive monthly gain, a sterling performance for a sector that lost jobs for 35 months in a row and was in its own private recession for over a dozen years. Manufacturing employment is now below where it was in 1941, not in percentage terms but in absolute numbers, a period when overall employment nearly quadrupled. Employment in bars and restaurants also grew, good news for the Sybarites among us. The unemployment rate held steady at a very high 9.7%, and the broadest measure of joblessness, the so-called U6 rate, which takes account of people working part-time who want full-time work but can't find it, as well as those who've given up the job search as hopeless, rose a tenth of a point to 16.8%, an extremely high number. Average hourly earnings fell by a tenth of a percent before adjusting for inflation. Declines in wages unadjusted for inflation are very rare. So despite the vaguely improving tone of the employment stats, the labor market continues to be very weak. As I said earlier, we're in a deep hole, and it's going to take a long time to get out of it.
Oh, but 2009 was a great year for the Masters of the Universe. The top 25 hedge fund managers pulled in an average of $1 billion last year. The man at the very top, David Tepper, took home $4 billion. Next up was that great liberal humanist George Soros at $3.3 billion. The poor relation at number 10, Philip Falcone, hauled in $825 million. The $25 billion this gang collectively earned, I use that word loosely, will be enough to pay the tuition for about 1 in 5 college and university students in the USA. That's only a hair less than what the federal government pays in all its tuition assistance programs. 25 guys, all men, by the way. What a country. And now a step backward in time. The excellent Glenn Ford of the BlackAgendaReport.com had a splendid polemic on the site the other day, tied to a Tavis Smiley TV special on Martin Luther King. Ford is tired of all the idiotic comparison of the current occupant of the White House to King. King denounced the U.S. economic order and the incredible waste of resources devoted to imperial war. As Ford puts it, 2 generations later, the military suction tube is still on full blast, and another lethal leech is sucking the economy dry, Wall Street. Who can doubt that Dr. King would be locked in confrontation with Obama were he alive today? I thought that it might be good to listen to a bit of King's speech against the Vietnam War, delivered at the Ebenezer Baptist Church, Atlanta, on April 30th, 1967.
There is at the outset a very obvious and almost facile connection between the war in Vietnam and the struggle I and others have been waging in America. A few years ago, there was a shining moment in that struggle. It seemed as if there was a real promise of hope for the poor, both black and white, through the poverty program. Then came the build-up in Vietnam, and I watched the program broken as if it was some idle political plaything of a society gone mad on war. And I knew that America would never invest the necessary funds or energies in rehabilitation of its poor, so long as adventures like Vietnam continued to draw men and skills and money like some demonic, destructive suction tube. And you may not know it, my friends, but it is estimated that we spend $500,000 to kill each enemy soldier, while we spend only $53 for each person classified as poor. And much of that $53 goes for salaries to people who are not poor. So I was increasingly compelled to see the war as an enemy of the poor and attack it as such. Perhaps the more tragic recognition of reality took place when it became clear to me that the war was doing far more than devastating the hopes of the poor at home. It was sending their sons and their brothers and their husbands to fight and die in extraordinarily high proportion relative to the rest of the population. We were taking the black young men who had been crippled by society and sending them 8,000 miles away to guarantee liberties in Southeast Asia, which they had not found in Southwest Georgia and East Harlem. So we have been repeatedly faced with the cruel irony of watching Negro and white boys on TV screens as they kill and die together for a nation that has been unable to seat them together in the same schoolroom. So we watch them in brutal solidarity burning the huts of a poor village. But we realize that they would hardly live on the same block in Chicago or Atlanta. As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. But they ask, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? They ask if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problems. And I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. America and most of its newspapers applauded me in Montgomery. And I stood before thousands of Negroes getting ready to riot when my home was bombed and said, "We can't do it this way." They applauded us in the sit-in movement, and we nonviolently decided to sit in at lunch counters. They applauded us on the freedom rides when we accepted blows without retaliation. Oh, the press was so noble in its applause and so noble in its praise when I was saying, "Be nonviolent toward Bull Connor." There's something strangely inconsistent about a nation and a press that will praise you when you say, "Be nonviolent toward Jim Clark," but will curse and damn you when you say, "Be nonviolent toward little brown Vietnamese children." There's something wrong with that press. Another burden of responsibility was placed upon me in 1964. And I cannot forget that the Nobel Peace Prize was not just something taking place, but it was a commission to work harder than I had ever worked before for the brotherhood of man. This is a calling that takes me beyond national allegiances, but even if it were not present, I would yet have to live with the meaning of my commitment to the ministry of Jesus Christ. To me, the relationship of this ministry to the making of peace is so obvious that I sometimes marvel at those who ask me why I am speaking against the war. Could it be that they do not know that the good news was meant for all men, for communists and capitalists, for their children and ours, for black and white, for revolutionary and conservative? Have they forgotten that my ministry is in obedience to the one who loved his enemies so fully that he died for them? What then can I say to the Viet Cong or to Castro or to Mao as a faithful minister to Jesus Christ? Can I threaten them with death? Or must I not share with them my life? There will be no meaningful solution until some attempt is made to know these people and hear their broken cries. And who are we supporting in Vietnam today? It's a man by the name of General Key, who fought with the French against his own people, and who said on one occasion that the greatest hero of his life is Hitler. This is who we are supporting in Vietnam today. Oh, our government and the press generally won't tell us these things, but God told me to tell you this morning. The truth must be told. And all the while, the people read our leaflets and received regular promises of peace and democracy and land reform. Now they languish under our bombs and consider us not their fellow Vietnamese, the real enemy. They see the children degraded by our soldiers as they beg for food. We have destroyed their two most cherished institutions, the family and the village. We have destroyed their land and their crops. This is a role our nation has taken, the role of those who make peaceful revolutions impossible, by refusing to give up the privileges and the pleasures that comes from the immense profits of overseas investment. Now, I'm convinced that if we are to get on the right side of the world revolution, we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. We must rapidly begin to shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society. When machines and computers, profit motives, and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, militarism, and economic exploitation are incapable of being conquered.
That was some of the closing chorus of Bach's St. Matthew Passion, performed by the Munich Bach Orchestra and Choir, conducted by Carl Richter. You don't get much religious material from me, because I'm not the least bit religious, but that is a sublime piece of music, and one of the few things I thought could stand up to that speech against the Vietnam War, delivered by Martin Luther King at Ebenezer Baptist Church, Atlanta, April 30th, 1967. And now, crashing back to Earth. Back in the 1990s, activists led by Jeff Ballinger campaigned against Nike's exploitation of the Indonesian workers who made their shoes. What happened to the workers? That question is addressed in a paper by Ann Harrison and Jason Scores, just published in the American Economic Review. Here's Ann Harrison, who teaches at Berkeley, with a report of their findings. Welcome, Ann Harrison. There was, of course, a lot of high-profile activism about sweatshops in Indonesia, particularly targeted at Nike some years ago. What happened? Were there actual reforms? Did wages rise? How'd things turn out?
You're talking about Indonesia in particular?
Well, let's start by talking about your paper. Yeah, you examined the Indonesian results.
Oh, sure. So I'm happy to talk about my paper. Indonesia is a particularly interesting case because the beginning of the anti-sweatshop movement there was essentially pioneered by one very enterprising individual named Jeff Ballinger. And he went to Indonesia and had money from USAID and realized when he was there that the factory workers in the garment footwear industry were massively underpaid and working under very poor conditions, and decided that he would sort of let people know about this, and focused in particular on Nike, and began a campaign. And at what started out as a one-man campaign soon blossomed. At its height of the campaign, there were maybe 1,000 articles written on this in any one year. And as a result of this campaign, the country increased wages in the footwear industry dramatically. Wages essentially doubled over a period of 6 years, and it was a remarkable campaign and very effective.
Now, someone with maybe a semester or two of economics courses would say that a couple of things might happen. One might be that the foreign investors would just pull up stakes and move elsewhere in search of lower wages. Did you find any evidence that that happened?
That's a some very interesting suggestions. So, for example, at Berkeley's anti-sweatshop movement, which focused on sort of the sweatshirts that were being produced primarily in Mexico, there was a little bit of evidence of that happening. And in Indonesia, you do see a little bit of that. You do see some evidence that some factories may have relocated to Vietnam, for example. But what's important to understand is that because Indonesia was one of the lowest cost locations in the entire world, a lot of these producers and foreign investors didn't have anywhere else to go. So the campaign targeted essentially the right country and the right sector, and this was a sector that could afford to pay more without losing the business of the foreign investor. So it was a very sort of clever strategy ex post.
What percentage of the total costs of manufacture are represented by labor costs?
Well, it's very small. So, for example, it's about 5%. So that means for a shoe that would cost $100, only $5 of that $100 shoe is actually going to the worker. So what that means, of course, is that there's a lot of cushion for employers to pay more.
Any sense of what the other costs are? Where's the other $95 go?
A lot of it is advertising, development, design, the middlemen. I can't give you the exact breakdown, but...
It was no problem for the manufacturers to raise wages and not really suffer very much.
That's correct. In fact, not only did they not suffer, but actually employment in this industry actually increased as higher wages were being paid to the workers.
What, if anything, can you say in general about the plants run by foreign investors versus domestic employers? Is there a significant difference in wages, labor conditions, that sort of thing?
Well, that's an excellent question because on average, I've done a lot of research on that. So on average, in most parts of the world and in most sectors, if you look at what foreign firms pay their workers, they actually tend to pay higher wages, not lower wages. And that's why you have people like Jagdish Bhagwati or Christoph writing in the New York Times saying, let's hear it for these sweatshops. Because in fact, in most cases, foreign firms are actually paying their workers higher wages relative to if you work for a domestically owned firm. However, and this is important, in the case of the garment and footwear industry, it wasn't the case. In that particular industry, foreign firms were actually paying very low wages. And that's why this was an important target of opportunity. And it was also the case, it's also important to understand that this is a sector which is dominated by female labor. So you have, you know, hundreds of workers that are not very assertive and not asserting their rights, and so it's easy for these foreign owners to come in and take advantage of them.
Let's step back a bit to the more general question. Foreign plants pay higher wages. How much of that could be accounted for by, say, difference of the quality of the workers or the quality of the equipment they work with, and how much is just a pure employer effect?
Oh, that's a really excellent question. That basically brings us to the current state of the research today. What we care about is sort of if it's because they bring in sort of better equipment or because they have sort of better inputs to work with, then as a worker, you don't care if that's the case. You just know that you're being paid higher wages. So that would be a good thing. If, on the other hand, they're just skimming, they're just basically getting all the better workers, then that's something to worry about because they're not actually raising wages. So there's some evidence that there is some of that. Foreign firms do come in, and they do tend to hire the better workers. So that contributes a little bit to why they pay higher wages, but not all the way. So there is a premium paid by the foreign firm.
And you mentioned that the workers in these plants are predominantly female. It is a pretty well-established proposition that occupations that are dominated by women are more poorly paid, even after all the other factors are accounted for, right?
Yes, that's true. In fact, it's true. It's true in the United States as well, and you see that sectors where the share of women grows, wages tend to actually fall in those sectors. But there's definitely, there's also a dis-premium pay to being a female worker, even in the United States. And that's, to me, one of the most amazing things, even though this discussion is about what was happening in Indonesia. I mean, in the United States, for every dollar paid to men, women only get paid 80 cents. And this is after you control for their educational quality and their experience. It's really remarkable.
This is, of course, a very big question, but why might that be?
Well, this is a long conversation. It depends on who you ask. If some people would say, well, there's a Larry Katz and Claudia Golden at Harvard University have recently done a study where they tracked every individual graduating from Harvard over the last 30, 40 years. And what they found is that at the beginning of the period, they actually were paid exactly the same amount, and that after a period of 10, 20 years, the wage differential was 50%. So for the same people who would graduate in the same from the same university, men were getting paid a dollar. After a long period, women were only paid 50 cents. And this is really striking. What they conclude from their study is that it's all choice, that women have chosen to exit the labor force at certain parts of their career to take care of their children, and that permanently reduces how much they earn. I'm extraordinarily skeptical of that interpretation of the data.
Well, it does depend upon what your definition of choice is, I suppose.
Absolutely.
Let's get back to Indonesia. So you found wages were increased and there was no significant decline in employment. That's correct.
That's correct. So in the Indonesian case, I really believe that this was a very unique case of win-win, in the sense that the wages of workers in the sectors that were targeted by the activist doubled, and employment also increased. So you don't get the usual cost in terms of sort of lost employment because wages are too high. So it was a very exciting and promising case study showing that the work of the activists has really made a difference.
So how much can we generalize from this? Is this very particular to country and sector, or is this something of more general interest?
Well, I think that you have to be very careful. I think it has to be the case where there are enormous rents. So it has to be the case where the firms are making a lot of profits, which could be shared with the workers. So this is not going to be the case in every sector. It has to be also the case that they're targeting sectors and workers who in some sense are underpaid relative to what they should be. And so you really have to choose, these activists have to choose the countries and the sectors very carefully in order to get this kind of win-win outcome.
And did you notice any effect on wage levels elsewhere in Indonesian economy, or is this very specific to this sector?
No, there are no positive effects elsewhere on the economy. If anything, there might even be a slight negative effect.
So if you were advising, I know this is not your role in life, but if you were advising anti-sweatshop activists, how would you advise them to choose targets?
So I would advise them to sort of find those regions of the world which essentially are, in fact, the lowest cost regions, so that you can't get this result that firms are able to relocate to other lower cost areas. So that would be the first thing. And then I would also advise them to choose carefully the segments of the market where firms are very comfortably making a lot of profits and workers are significantly underpaid relative to the norm. However, the sort of the movement as it initially started, where activists were asking for workers to be essentially paid the same everywhere else, that of course is not a reasonable recommendation, and it's not sustainable.
So when you say the lowest cost regions, that would probably exclude China right now then, wouldn't it?
Well, China, there has been a significant increase in wages in many sectors in China. So it would depend basically on the sector that you chose.
And you mentioned earlier the anti-sweatshop activists who are focusing on the t-shirts and sweatshops that universities sell in their bookstores. What kind of results have you found from that sort of activism?
I haven't focused specifically on that, but there was some work that was done looking at what happened to the factories that sourced for UC Berkeley, for example. And there were some positive outcomes, but there were also some evidence that some of these factories had, in fact, relocated elsewhere. So that is a risk, and that's something that activists need to take into account.
So something like Nike, where the name brand matters a lot and the price is quite high and it's a lot about glitz and snazzy stuff, that's really a pretty ideal target.
Very attractive target, yes, absolutely.
That was the Berkeley economist Anne Harrison. We'll be back to talk about Europe after this break. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood. That program is Behind the News. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about Europe.
Let me tell you how it will be. That's one for you, 19 for me. 'Cause I'm the taxman. Appear too small. Be thankful I don't take it all. 'Cause I'm the tax man.
Yeah, I'm the tax man. If you drive a car,
I'll tax the street.
If you try to sit, I'll tax your seat.
How's some of the Beatles' song Taxman, performed by those 1960s greats, The Music Machine? They were nothing like the Beatles' tax bracket, of course. As everyone knows, Europeans are taxed to death. It'll all about collecting dole checks, or something like that. Stephen Hill is out with a new book, Europe's Promise, published by the University of California Press, that holds up Europe as an economic and social model for us. I think he idealizes a bit too much, but let's hear him make his case. Stephen Hill.
I guess now with the U.S. In economic crisis, having dragged a good bit of the world along with it into that sorry state, we're not hearing quite the same number of lectures coming out of Washington about how Europe needs to get its house in order now, are we? It looks like the positions are perhaps a little reversed.
Yes, that's right. I mean, prior to the economic collapse, the U.S. was quite the preacher around the world in pushing the Washington consensus, or what I call Wall Street capitalism model of development. But now that that model has kind of crashed and burned, you see a little bit more openness, both in the United States, but definitely in other parts of the world, to other types of models of development. And that's where the European way, or what I call social capitalism, seems to be getting a new look in many ways. You've seen a lot of slew of articles out recently on Germany and its export economy and things like co-determination, which allows workers to actually elect members of the boards of directors of major corporations. All these sorts of things are suddenly appearing in the media, whereas a few years ago it was pretty hard to find these sorts of references in the media.
Let's talk about a couple of things that American pundits like to say about Europe, or did until the wind got knocked out of their sails. Start with chronically high unemployment, especially among youths. This was a common rap against Europe. Now that our unemployment rate is just below 10%, it's a little harder to talk about a contrast in unemployment rates, but review the recent history of this for us.
Well, Europe actually has lower unemployment, and by Europe I mean the 27 nations of the European Union has lower unemployment than we have. And interestingly, while in the United States our unemployment rate has more than doubled during this economic crisis, countries like Germany, the unemployment rate has barely gone up because they pursued different policies. For example, in Germany, they instead of laying off millions of German workers, they had everybody cut back a little bit, short work, as they call it. So instead of working 100%, they're working maybe 90 or 80%. But they squirreled away some money during the good years. So if you go from 100% to 80%, you're still getting 90% of salary. and that means more people still have money in their pockets. You don't see such a drop in consumer spending, which further fuels the downward economic cycle. It also means you don't have the devastation of layoffs where families and entire communities get really hurt badly. And yet when Robert Rubin, who's one of President Obama's closest advisors, was asked about this short work, he said, that's not American. In America, we're about creating new jobs, not about preserving old jobs, as if there's a you can't do both. And so it really shows, I think, how the U.S., we're so locked in a rigid ideology about free market enterprise, even though the American version of free market enterprise, the government bails out big banks. You know, we privatize the gains, socialize the losses. That's what American Wall Street capitalism is about. So, you know, I think in many ways Europe is more pragmatic about these things, and you see those differences being reflected now in lower unemployment, especially in certain countries where the unemployment rate really hasn't been affected very much during this economic crisis.
Another app, of course, is that Europe is stodgy, not as vital and as creative, as innovative as the United States, and they kind of live in a open-air museum, as I believe one Morgan Stanley analyst put it a few years ago.
Certainly, that's another one of the stereotypes you see. You also see that it's a weak, sclerotic economy. It's socialist. It's red tape and bureaucracy strangling their businesses. And yet when I, you know, and I sort of assumed all that when I first began traveling to work Europe to study these things, and only to find out that Europe actually has more Fortune 500 companies than the United States has. In fact, it has more Fortune 500 companies than the United States and China combined. It also has more small businesses that produce two-thirds of the jobs compared to a small business that produces about half the jobs in the United States. It's the largest trading partner with both the United States and China at this point. It's the highest target of foreign direct investment by American businesses. In fact, they make 20 times more profit in Europe than they make in China. So you'd think if it was all these things, weak, sclerotic economy, red tape, bureaucracy, socialism, and this isn't socialism. This is Fortune 500 companies, more than we have in the United States, but it's what I call social capitalism. They've figured out how do you take the ability of capitalism to create wealth. And there's no question that capitalism is the greatest wealth creator that humans have ever invented. But there's a question there. Who gets that wealth? Whose pockets does that wealth go into? And Europe has figured out how to harness that wealth and create this more broadly shared prosperity. That's really what's going on there. And in terms of being innovative, what place has done more to innovate and to put in place all the renewable technologies and all the conservation technologies that is really what the whole world needs to begin doing if we're going to really grapple with climate change? And that's Europe. Europe has done far more to implement these technologies, and some of them were technologies invented in the United States, and yet they put them in place more in Europe than we're doing here. So I sort of turn that question on its head. What is it about the United States that is not very innovative, even though these technologies, some of them have been invented here? What is it about us that can't implement these technologies in a very widespread fashion? At this point, Europe's ecological footprint, as it's called, is half that of the United States for the same standard of living because they've done so much more to implement renewable and conservation technologies.
A related issue, the class structure of Europe is very much more ossified than ours. We have a great deal of fluidity and mobility, whereas the old Europe is still stuck in a very hierarchical, stratified class system.
Well, I mean, what do you mean by that? Because one of the things I cite in the book is there was a study done a couple of years ago, and it was actually cited in the Wall Street Journal showing that old Europe now has more economic mobility than we have here in the United States. So do you mean within job classifications, or what exactly do you mean by that?
Well, I think the standard line is that kind of inheritance of class structure. In the United States, one can be born poor and get rich, whereas in Europe, you're destined to follow in the footsteps of your parents.
Yeah, and that's what this study from a few years ago was actually refuting, that whole notion. It really turns convention on its head to think that Europe is actually more economically mobile, that more people can start poor in Europe and get up into the middle class, maybe not get into becoming fabulously wealthy. We still have that kind of myth around the American dream that you can get as much as you want. But in fact, more and more people in the United States are having a hard time acquiring that dream. We have 14% of Americans who live below the poverty line. That's 41 million Americans compared to a place like France that only has 6% poverty, Germany, Sweden with only 5%. Britain is about the highest with 8% poverty level, which is still only about half of the poverty level in the United States. So, I mean, again, social mobility, economic mobility, it seems to me this is another one of these myths that you hear a lot and turns out on closer scrutiny to not be exactly as they make it out to be.
Another story we hear here is that Europeans are sweating under an immeasurably huge tax burden. And, you know, whereas we have a low tax, people are allowed to keep more of their money, as they like to say.
Yeah, and, you know, there's a degree of truth in a lot of these things, but again, most of the time these things are too simplistic. So, for example, Europeans pay more in taxes, but Americans pay a lot more out of pocket to receive the same things that Europeans get in return for their taxes. So if you're an American who's paying escalating health care premiums, Anthem Blue Cross just announced they're going to be increasing their premiums by up to 40%. If you're an American paying higher deductibles, higher co-payments, if you are going to a university or, you know, a college, you're paying a lot for tuition. American students tend to graduate with tens of thousands of dollars in debt. But in Europe, health care you get in return for your taxes. University education in many countries in Europe is still free, and for some now you pay $500 or $600 a year for tuition. If you are an American that needs to have child care, an average American family with two children is spending in excess of $12,000 a year for child care. In Europe, you're spending maybe $2,000, $2,500 depending on the country, and they give your children lunch when you bring them there. So in many, many ways, you see that Americans pay for all these things out of pocket. And so, of course, the rebuttal to that would be, well, it's discretionary. You don't have to pay if you don't want to. You don't have the government pickpocketing you and taking your money. Well, you know, is healthcare really discretionary today? Is a university education or some sort of job training discretionary? Is having child care or paid sick leave or more vacations, are these things really discretionary? These are all the things that Europeans are getting in exchange for their taxes. And really, when you add it up, you discover that Americans are paying out just as much as Europeans are paying out, both in terms of taxes and out-of-pocket payments. We're just getting a lot less for our money because we do it in this very ad hoc way where you can't create good, efficient systems like healthcare. And that's why healthcare, this decentralized hodgepodge that we have, we're paying 17% of our GDP on healthcare compared to Germany paying 8%. In many, many ways, we are not getting our money's worth, and the idea that Europeans are just paying taxes, that comes from places like Forbes magazine's Tax Misery Index, where all they look at is income tax, Social Security, and sales tax, or VAT. And if you just look at those three things, then yeah, there's Europe up there at the top of the list, the most tax miserable, and there's the United States down there, happy as a clam around Indonesia, Malaysia, and the Philippines. But the reality is that Americans are still paying a lot of money out of pocket to get the same things that Europeans are getting in exchange for their taxes, and it's another myth that just doesn't hold up to scrutiny.
And another story we hear, not entirely consistent with the earlier stuff, is that Europe is full of idlers who are living on the dole, living in the past, where Americans are busy beavers, busily creating the future.
Well, you know, again, I don't, you know, when you travel Europe and, you know, as many Americans have, you don't get the sense of all these people kicking back on the dole. They do have more vacation there. You know, they have about 4 to 5 weeks vacation, whereas the average American only has about 2 weeks. And in fact, the United States is one of the few countries in the world that does not have mandatory paid vacation. There are Americans that are not entitled to any vacation, and they have to self-subsidize when they, you know, take time off from work. They don't get paid. You know, I would say that people need a sufficient amount of leisure and time away, and it actually makes them better workers. There's all sorts of studies that have been done documenting this, that when workers are rested and they're feeling appreciated by their employer, their productivity goes up. And when productivity comes up, your business makes more money because your workers are producing more for every hour they're there. So, you know, it seems to me you can take a short-sighted view of any of these things and say that somehow, you know, Europeans get too much vacation. But it actually may be that the flip side is what's true, is that Americans don't get enough.
I'm speaking with Stephen Hill, author of Europe's Promise, just out from the University of California Press. Let's talk specifically about a couple of more things. You have a chapter about the transportation innovations going on in Europe, that land of open-air museum. What are they doing getting people around?
Well, what Europe is trying to figure out is, you know, how do you have a wealthy society today but do it in a way that reduces your carbon emissions and the impacts of development? Because, you know, there is this thing out there called global climate change or global warming. And that means that all the major industrial countries are the biggest carbon polluters in the world. The United States uses far more carbon per capita than any other country in the world. In fact, the average American uses twice as much carbon, emits twice as much carbon through all their activities, that carbon is part of the process of development and emission. The average American uses twice as much as the average European, over four times as the average person from China, and over eight times the average person from India. So we really have the most to do here to carry our weight. And so Europe has started to do things like, you know, some of it is low-hanging fruit. They have motion sensor lights. They have, you know, ways that when the light, if someone is in the room, then motion sensors make the lights go off. They have these low wattage light bulbs. Their toilets flush less water. Their cars use less fuel. It takes 40% more fuel to go a mile in an American vehicle than it does in a European vehicle. But they also have the high tech trains and high speed trains that not only take you around the city but zip you from city to city. They're doing things like big solar arrays so that, you know, in addition to solar on people's rooftops, they have these vast solar arrays that can produce serious amount of megawattage of electricity. They have wind farms both on the land and the sea. They're even doing very interesting, even eye-popping things to harness power of the sea. Imagine taking a windmill and sinking it beneath the sea and bolting it to the seabed, and as it just turns there in the ocean currents, making energy. They're doing this off the coast of Britain now. So they're doing all these sorts of things, and I mean, some of the other interesting things they do is what's called combined heat and power, or cogeneration, where in the power of making energy at a power plant, about 40% of the energy is lost up the chimney stack just through heat. Well, in Europe, they're taking this heat and channeling it into pipes and taking it to people's homes and to businesses' buildings to heat them. So just many, many ways they're looking for every type of energy efficiency they can find, and they're doing it. They've implemented all these things, and the process, they've created an entire green industry, hundreds of thousands of jobs, that now is exporting some of this technology to places like China and India that need it. And so there's no trade-off between the environment and the economy. Europe has figured out a way to make this work. And, of course, President Obama has discussed this as well, but he hasn't been able to get 60 votes in the Senate to get things past the filibuster-going wild Senate to do many of the creative things that I think he would like to do.
But there are some blemishes, and perhaps the most prominent social one is immigration. Europe seems to have a lot more trouble assimilating populations born elsewhere than, or where parents were born elsewhere, grandparents were born elsewhere, than we do in the United States. Why is that? Why do they have such a trouble with some of their brown-skinned residents, especially those of the Islamic faith?
I think the reason is because they've been at it for less amount of time than we have. You know, they're probably where we were 20 to 30 years ago, in part because their minorities were never substantial enough to really push on this issue. And, you know, I mean, it's simply the case that whether it's the United States or Europe or any society, you have a majority population and a minority population, and it's not till the minority population becomes big enough that the majority population wants to deal with it. Instead, they always marginalize them and to some degree exploit them. And once they suddenly notice this minority population, then a movement arises to deport them, to get them out of the country, only to discover that no self-respecting democracy can do that sort of thing, because it would unleash massive human rights violations. And then also you realize that these minority populations actually occupy an indispensable niche in your economy. So at that point, a parallel movement arises to begin the integration process. And that's where I would describe Europe is right now. They realize they have a problem. They've begun doing things to foster this integration. They're spending tens of billions of euros across the continent on things like language classes, hotlines to report discrimination. Countries like Austria, for the first time in their history, have passed anti-discrimination laws. They have radio programs in Kurd language and North African languages. They have soap operas now with, like, the multiracial Brady Bunch, if you will, where that, you know, is some of the most popular shows in various countries are these sorts of soap operas in which these kind of issues are dealt with in a cinematic way. So these are the sorts of things that are going on in Europe. What will be the future for Europe? It's anybody's guess. My sense is that Europe, in terms of immigration like this, my sense is that Europe in 2030 is not going to look like what it is today. They're in the process of becoming a rainbow Europe, and we'll see if the European leaders have the sensibility and the vision to figure out how to make this integration work. I mean, they really don't have an immigration problem because they actually need a certain degree of immigration. They have an integration problem. You know, the French youth that burned 10,000 cars a few years ago, they were not immigrants. They had lived there, they were born there. The only language they spoke was French. Second and third generation, what they have is an integration problem, and that's what they have to focus on. And as far as I can tell, that is what they're focusing on. But these things take time.
Now, also, since you wrote the book, the periphery of Europe has entered economic crisis. You've got countries like Iceland, Greece, Latvia, all in varying degrees of deep recession to depression. And the reaction of the European policy elite, the central bank and the European Commission and such, has been really as austere as anything that the United States ever imposed in Latin America. And this, there's a kind of German sadomonetarism radiating out from the center of Europe to its periphery. How does that fit into your picture?
Maybe before I launch on that one, let me just say that there's a website for the book, www.europespromise.org, where people can find out more information about the book. And there's op-eds, you know, written about the themes of the book from in different publications on all these different topics. What's happening in Europe right now is somewhat similar to what's happening all around the world. The world suffered an economic earthquake, if you will, of 8.0 on the Richter scale. A year and a half, 2 years ago, and we're seeing aftershocks all over the world. I mean, I'm from California. California is certainly a place of aftershocks. In fact, last summer in California, because we were in danger of default, we had to issue IOUs in order to pay our bills. And the city of L.A. just laid off another 5,000 employees. Programs are being cut back. This is unfortunate, but no one seems to have found a solution to how to do this. In this economic collapse, consumer spending dropped, business spending dropped. The only entity left to spend to get the economy moving again was government. So you have every government around the world virtually that has run up huge deficits, including in Europe, including the United States. So, in terms of the specifics of Greece and some of the other countries, Portugal and others that I've mentioned, they are in the process of having to deal with these deficits in a short-term fashion that's going to be painful. You have a country like Greece where, I mean, it's only 2% of Europe's economy compared to California, which is 14% of the American economy. So it's a bite size that Europe should be able to handle. But you also have a situation in which some people in Greece have been able to retire at the age of 50 or even 55. Extremely young, and that kind of stuff is going to be cut back. And you have a country like Germany where they've just increased the age of retirement from 65 to 67, and they're thinking, why should we pay to bail you out when our people don't get to retire till 65 now and 10 years 67, and you're retiring much, much earlier. So I think in some ways what's occurring is you're going to see more of a harmonization across Europe of many things having to do with these social supports that families and individuals receive, where some countries are going to have to change theirs in order to come up to what other countries are doing. So, you know, this is obviously a work in progress, but I think that some positives is actually a silver lining coming out of this in a couple of ways. One, Europe had no tradition prior to this of any financial backstop. So if a member state got in trouble, there was no tradition of any members bailing each other out, like in the United States where the federal government, at least in theory, can bail out American states. Though when California came to the Obama administration and asked for help, the Obama administration refused, and that's why it led to California putting out their IOUs. But now you're seeing the beginnings of an attempt to create a European Monetary Fund. So there was just an agreement last week in which many of the other countries in Europe agreed to put up loans if Greece needs it in order to make sure they don't default. This has never happened in Europe before. In some ways it's bringing Europe closer together, but it's a painful process in doing that. Europe also now has proposed that Eurostat, which is the data collection agency of the European Union, can more aggressively look at the books of member states so that you don't have another situation where Goldman Sachs is going to be helping a country like Greece to hide its debt. Finally, Europe also has begun looking at other ways to crack down on hedge funds and and derivatives and credit default swaps. They first proposed this last year, about a year ago, at the G20, and Timothy Geithner, the Secretary of the Treasury, has been dragging his feet on this, but the Greece situation is finally pushed Europe to say, you know what, we're not waiting for the U.S. anymore. We are going to crack down on these derivatives and hedge funds, and that's just all there is to it. So, you know, it's not a pretty picture, but there does seem to be some positives coming out of it.
So you don't think the whole process of European economic integration is running off the rails?
No, not at all. I mean, if you look at the history of the European Union, I mean, first of all, even though we call it old Europe, the European Union is quite young. In fact, its current final configuration, if it is final, of 27 nations, 500 million people, only dates to 2004. The Lisbon Treaty, that's supposed to address some of the leadership issues, was only signed last October. The Maastricht Treaty creating the EU only dates from 1992. So this is a pretty new entity. I mean, if you flash back to our own history, from the time of our first government in 1790, it took about 80 years for the United States to congeal and to cease being a loose collection of regions and to deal with some of the contradictions that were there at the beginning of our nation's founding. So, I see this as kind of speed bumps in Europe's trajectory as they figure out just how united do they want to be. Do they want to ever be a United States of Europe? Probably not, but certainly this is much more united than, say, the old Articles of Confederation. It's really something completely new and different that the world has never seen before, and it's a work in progress. So, and they seem to play out these things very much in public, and so you really get this impression of countries running around like chickens with their heads chopped off. But the fact is, Europe has always progressed through crisis. A crisis emerges, they have to figure out what to do. They come up with solutions, and then they move on. And so far, from what I can tell, this is fitting that pattern fairly well.
That was Stephen Hill, author of Europe's Promise, just out from the University of California Press. You can find out more about the book by visiting europespromise.com. That's one word, europespromise.com. I was taken a bit aback by his apologetics for austerity and his deployment of the canard of the 50-year-old retirement age in Greece. Greece is going through the economic ringer right now. Yes, they've got a serious debt problem, not only there but elsewhere in the euro periphery. But debt and geography crystallize a deep inequality behind the pleasant life of the euro center, from whom the immigrants and their offspring are also excluded. This all brings up some troubling issues about whether solidarity can live with heterogeneity. Hill doesn't really address that, or how the process of European integration has from the first been an elite top-down one, not a democratic project. It's been much more about the free movement of capital than the free movement of people. I don't want to deny there's a lot to admire and even envy in European social democracy. It would be very nice to have some of those things here in the USA, but one shouldn't over-idealize the thing. Okay, that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this from Defunct, a bit of their 1982 song, Thermonuclear Sweat. Till next week, bye. Take what you can, I'll be taking. Said move.